Muller House Meeting, Sunday afternoon, 26th September 1976.
We have all heard that phrase, the marriage made in heaven. Poets, psychologists, and scholars have written about it. But it is doubtful whether many have ever penetrated into the original root, the transcendental root of this phrase. Yesterday, we considered something very deep in relation to it, this timeless conjugation of the primordial creative energy in its positive and negative aspects, the male and the female, interacting, which produces the whole universal process. Of this, only few through the ages have ever really known or touched. We have tried to see it with our ordinary minds. And it is quite natural for us to say that this is obviously right beyond us as we are. That may be the case. But whilst that is the first and the profoundest meaning of the marriage made in heaven, there are other meanings also. And the meaning which concerns us who wish to live the religious life, to realize the fulfillment of our true humanity and our human destiny, that meaning is something which we can understand quite clearly. And that meaning is simply this. In each and every one of us, individual human beings, there are both masculine and feminine elements, qualities, forces operating. In modern Europe, we use these terms animus and anima. Every man has this female anima. Every woman has this male or masculine animus. And both elements function within our psyche. They both have different purposes, different modes of influencing our lives. Insofar as each of us is able to understand the two aspects in our nature, in our own nature, the male and the female aspects, understand them fully, we bring about a complete harmony of the whole psyche. This is another meaning, a very practical meaning of the marriage made in heaven where we are concerned. Because if these two aspects of our own psyche are in perfect harmony, they interact constantly and constructively, and they reflect that transcendental harmony of the transcendental marriage, which is the ultimate origin of love in its supreme sense and of all creative activity. So, our task here, the beginning, so to say, of our being able not only to have the vision, but perhaps to touch that transcendental reality, is in releasing harmony within our own being. Now, this does not mean what is often meant by the psychologist at large. His task apparently is so to help a person to understand himself from the worldly point of view that he can face the world as it is without necessarily undergoing that transformation of his own nature which makes him the true human being. The work of most psychologists ends with recirculating a worldling into the world as it is, accepting the values of the world, being in tune with the ways of the world. But being in tune with the ways of the world does not lift our world out of its appalling conflicts and its unending sorrow. This is what we have still to learn from the ordinary, as far as the ordinary psychological point of view is concerned. The great founders of the religions, the spiritual teachers, the holy ones, the really holy ones, were also psychologists. But they were psychologists with a very great difference from our trained psychologists of today. They had undergone that process of purification and of emergence, complete emergence and freedom from the worldly state, the worldly outlook. That is to say, the self-enclosed outlook. They had come completely out of that and realized what it meant to have the utterly pure mind. This is something the whole host of worldly psychologists, practicing psychologists, do not know. They may know of it in so many words, but to know this in the real sense means that oneself is like that. Psychological or mental or what is sometimes called spiritual healing, is rooted in the actual psychological, spiritual, mental state of the one who practices the healing. Now, the perfected holy ones had actually become utterly pure where the mind was concerned. Therefore, their outlook on life, their vision, their understanding, their psychical and their psycho-spiritual power was something quite different from what we ordinarily know of. They had this other great advantage too. Not only had they come to know what the pure mind, the utterly mature, healthy mind is, but they also, because they had climbed out of the ordinary state of human beings in distress and in disharmony, knew all about the ordinary human mind, which is in disharmony, in discord, which is the ill mind, the diseased state, the source of evil for mankind. There is no evil other than that which we experience through the disharmony of our own psyche, the imperfections of our own psyche. Apart from that, there is no evil. Because howsoever painful material experiences may be, like earthquakes or floods or famines or whatever it is, however dreadful they may be, they in themselves are without any qualities. Who shall say to an earthquake, "You are evil," or "You are good"? You can't. An earthquake is an earthquake. It is our reaction to it which makes us say, how horrible, how evil. Painful, yes. But in the psychical, moral sense, or the aesthetic sense, the intellectual sense, there is no evil apart from the evil of our own conflicting state. Now the perfected holy ones knew the mind of man, of all men, individual men, and they also knew what it was to have the utterly purified mind. Therefore, when they met anyone, they knew that person for what he actually was, without that person telling them anything about himself. You know how in our own experience we come across human beings. Some of us may have the ability ourselves to meet a person and know what his character is like. Up to a point only do we perceive and understand what his character is like, what are the troubles in his soul, so to say. We can know that without his telling us. We know it. But what we know in our little way is incomparably less, inadequate, imperfect, compared with what the one whose mind is really pure knows at once. It is a little bit like this. Supposing I have some gift, musical composition, or the gift for writing some poetry. But I'm only a beginner and amateur. And if I show my composition to an established, really great genius of a composer, he takes a glance at it and he knows just what sort of composition I have produced. He will be able to see into it with a thoroughness and a completeness which is denied me. I haven't got it yet. I have to grow to that. My growth into that state is a purification of my mental capacity, of my musical gift and capacity. It is something like that. The perfected one knows the mind. Therefore, he is able to show the person who is imperfect how he may bring about this true marriage made in heaven between the masculine and the feminine, the positive and the negative aspects of his own psyche, of his own character. Now, let us consider, therefore, one other point in this connection. It is here that religion is completely different, and the religious life is completely different from anything else that there is in man's cultural and everyday life. Utterly different from philosophy, science, art, any skills, any technologies, and so forth. Man's salvation, man's ability to live in as a society of happy, healthy, mature beings depends upon this unification of the masculine and the feminine aspects. And neither philosophy, nor science, nor art, nor any sort of experimental psychological investigation of the type which has existed so far during the last couple of centuries, century or two, you see, none of those things can give in completeness, with thoroughness, the perfection that religion can give. This is why religious truths are first so utterly simple that they escape our complicated minds. We are so complicated that we don't see that this simple thing is the perfect, the complete thing. Religious truths are utterly simple, and they go to the very heart of our existence. One of our great difficulties is that we cannot understand the real meaning and significance of religious truths, for the simple reason that our minds, being conditioned as they are by our ordinary life, have lost the power of seeing the truth as the truth and seeing the false as the false. In other words, our intelligence, in the real meaning of the word intelligence, is not awake. We may be very clever, we may be very learned, we may have all kinds of skills, but still our intelligence in the real sense is not awake and not functioning. You may ask, well, what do you mean by intelligence? Intelligence in the truly human context, that is, in the context of the perfect, of the true, natural, spontaneous human and not the subhuman, is the capacity of the mind to see the fact as the fact, without its being twisted by what we would like to see or what we imagine we see in any situation or person or event, etc. This is something which he whose psyche is purified and has this marriage of the masculine and feminine elements in it, he can see cleanly and purely. See, the psyche sees with the whole of itself. The psyche has no separate organs, like eyes and ears and liver and kidneys or any such thing. The psyche is a whole functioning. It's a mysterious functioning. If you can imagine that your whole body will act as eyes or ears or the sense of touch or taste, or your whole body will act like the blood acts or the lungs act or the heart acts. I mean, we can't imagine it, can we? We separate them all out and then we say, now here is a complete body functioning harmoniously. But the psyche is not like that. When you see with the mind, can you separate a little bit of the mind and say, this part of the mind is the thing which sees? Or this part of the mind is the thing which hears or understands this or the other? God. It's a whole manifestation. We can only talk of it in terms of positive and negative forces at play, because there is this dual activity, which is mind in action in us, the receptive and the responsive. Mind is a receptive, responsive sensitivity of the whole living person. That is what it is. You see? Now, let us look a little bit into the psyche and its functioning and nature. We have already talked a little bit about how we are constituted. There is the body with the brain and the nervous system and the ductless glands, which are specially important. There is this thing we call universal mind, this creative energy which, interacting with the particular body and therefore the particular formation of the brain above all, and the activity of the nerve, of the ductless glands, gives rise to our own individual psyche. None of us really have an individual separate mind, distinctive mind. Mind is the universal thing. Just as matter, if you like to use the word matter, is the universal thing out of which the particular body is formed. And the variety available is infinite as far as the body is concerned. And every single human being who is born has a brain and the activity of the ductless glands, which is different from everybody else's. So this universal energy, mind, which is of no special characteristics as such, this energy interacting with the living body through the brain and the ductless gland activity and so forth, gives rise to your own special individual psyche. That is to say, your mental functioning, your intellectual and emotional and aesthetic processes will be special to you. They will be different from everybody else's. Their mode of growth and expression and change and so on will be special to you. You can talk of your psyche, but to talk of your own mind is not so accurate. It's slightly mistaken, I think. Of course, remember, I may be wrong. Don't take my words as gospel truth, for goodness sake. I am just an ordinary human being. Very good. So there is the body, the brain, there is psyche, and there is this universal energy of mind, the mysterious energy, which continuously is affecting the whole of the manifested universe, and particularly us. I say particularly simply because the effect on us is not like the effect on a plant or an animal or a stone or something else. And the psyche is the link between the brain and pure mind. And the brain is also a link between psyche and pure mind. Now all impressions, physical impressions, because of physical processes, activities, events, phenomena, they affect the brain through the senses. The senses, the bodily senses and the nervous system convey the impressions to the brain. And as a result of those impressions, there is a corresponding psychical reaction. I like this impression, or I don't like this impression. Because the impression is either pleasurable physically, or it is painful. There is also a third state, the neutral state, where the impression is just an impression. It's neither pleasurable nor painful. The psyche remains perfectly poised and doesn't specially say, I like this or I dislike it. But when the psyche definitely says, I like this, now the trouble begins. It wants to have more and more of the pleasurable impressions. We are the slaves of pleasure. And it dislikes the painful sensations and wants either to get rid of them or to destroy the source from which they come. The pleasure-pain mechanism of the body is absolutely necessary for bodily survival. It is just a mechanical pleasure-pain mechanism. Because if that pleasure-pain mechanism wasn't there bodily, through the nerves and the brain as such, the body would soon perish. It wouldn't know that this particular source of impressions on the body is so painful, so destructive, that it will destroy you. Well, that's the end of it. You can't grow or develop at all in any way. It is very important to understand this very carefully. It is not pleasure which is evil, what we call pleasure. It is not pain which is evil. nor is pleasure or pain good in itself. Neither of them are either good or evil. It is the psychical reaction which introduces the trouble. Because when we want more and more of what we like, we are exercising a preferential choice. Instead of understanding life in its wholeness, in its totality. Life is such that it won't continue in any particular living form if there is a rejection of any part of it. We have to live in terms of wholeness. So, when we become enslaved by our pleasure drive and are unable to obtain that pleasure again and again, then we experience resentment. Hate springs up. It starts right from infancy onwards. The little infant thoroughly enjoys suckling its mother's breasts. And when mother feels that, infant has had enough, and takes the infant away, listen to the yelling of the infant in anger. Thoroughly angry, thoroughly upset and annoyed. It wants more. Greed, when frustrated, produces hate, resentment. So you see how important is the psychological correspondent of the physical pleasure-pain mechanism. Now, if the upbringing and the education hasn't been fortunate enough to be of a really healthy, balanced, a right sort, then the growing child's mind is conditioned largely in a destructive way. And the worst element of that destructiveness is that it conceives of itself as separate from and fighting against a hostile world. The average man, anywhere in the world, hasn't a natural, warm, strong sense of unity with the world, with the environment. He thinks in terms of competition, of overcoming this, of defeating that, of fighting against this. He cannot think creatively, constructively, livingly. He's not capable of it. Deep in his consciousness is this element of continuous conflict. And he wants to assert the I, his self-consciousness, against his environment. He wants to dominate his environment. He wants to exploit people around him and the earth and the whatever the earth produces. He wants to exploit it for his own pleasure, because at the same time as all this takes place, his passion for pleasure increases more and more all the time. And when this passion for pleasure increases all the time, in this manner, in terms of conflict, he misses the experience of true joy, true happiness. True joy and happiness is perfectly healthy. It is not dependent upon the fulfillment of particular sensations only, sensations which are desired. This is man's problem. This is where his inner education has to come in. He wants pleasure. And we all know, we've all done it in our own young days at least, how we never cease grasping at pleasure, pleasure, pleasure all the time. At fever heat, we are seeking pleasure. What we desire, we don't look, we don't understand, we don't see the wholeness of life and the beauty of life. And we are unable to be in harmony with it. So this self-conscious I is perpetually separate from what we commonly call the not I. And we are in conflict with it. We've got to win out. We've got to fight for this, etc., etc. And remember, there are several thousand million human beings in the world who are all like that. How can we have a harmonious world if right from within ourselves there comes out this conflict all the time? We don't live in the world, with the world, for the world, but we live struggling against the world. We want to be victorious over everything else, over everything which is contrary to our unintelligent desire. This is where the tremendous problem therefore arises. How shall a man live? We are all self-conscious, of course. But if we live self-centeredly, trying to draw the whole world to us all the time, we shall be in perpetual conflict, not only with the external world, but within ourselves also. Because we are born with this universal power working through every single thing in the universe and through us also for producing a harmony of manifestation where the particular person or tree or animal or whatever it is concerned. Our duty is to try and understand that. But we don't try. We are self-enclosed, self-concerned. We try to draw the world to us instead of being empty within ourselves and opening out to the world. Then nature itself, in the transcendent sense, takes charge and works out our true destiny as fully fledged human beings. Now you see, we haven't got that. And this is where the whole question of enlightenment comes in. Enlightenment is not obtained through acquiring mere knowledge. Enlightenment is the power to see things exactly as they are, without the distortion produced by our particular desires, our particular drives, and our particular conditioning. Now this, of course, is an extremely difficult task. Very difficult indeed. What is the secret of it, really? We have systems of thought. We have conflicting ideas. But all our systems of thought have emerged out of our distorted vision and understanding of the real nature of things. Above all, through our self-centeredness, we think and are conscious of ourselves as separate from everything else. We are not. We are part and parcel of a great totality. But we are, although we may say so, because the intellect may logically deduce that, inwardly, we are not really alive to the truth of that. Hence our state of conflicts. We are self-centeredly self-conscious. Self-conscious we have to be. But we have to be open at the same time to the totality. If we are not open to the totality, this self-consciousness puts us into conflict with the world in which we live. And this is where the trouble begins. The state of dis-ease arises from this conflict. Now, the mere intellectual acceptance of certain ideas won't heal us. We have to learn to remain quiet. Quiet within ourselves. Just sensitive to everything that is happening. Responding to it without any element going out from us which tends to produce a disharmony. And this is not easy. Not at all easy. It's very difficult. Because all our conditioning by human beings around us tends to keep us self-enclosed instead of open to the totality. If we are open to the totality, the tremendously egoistic assertion of the self begins to dissolve. And then the whole situation changes. We can't determine to be unselfish. Our determination to become unselfish won't work that way, won't work rightly. If we allow ourselves to grow naturally and quietly without interfering with the life process, then the conflict of selfishness and unselfishness disappears, and one opens up to the whole reality. This is not at all easy. Where lies the secret of such opening out? You know how in the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says, "He who seeth action in inaction, and inaction in action, he seeth truly." Ordinary action is self-motivated. It is all with the intention of obtaining something for ourselves. We want to draw from the whole universe to ourselves. That is the usual drive in human beings. But such activity is the very root and source of all disharmony. If we keep quiet, that is, this limited self-conscious self, person, keeps quiet within himself, then he awakes to the totality. And it is the totality which begins to function naturally and harmoniously through him. Then one is in harmony within oneself and between oneself and what we commonly call the not-self. And then the great illusion from which mankind has suffered from the beginning and suffers today more than ever perhaps, the great illusion that one is a separate self disappears. The very root of selfishness vanishes. And so, the transformation of our own nature, our freedom out of the constricted, imprisoned state into the state of true freedom, can begin out of the subhuman state into the fully human state, can then begin. For this, in actual fact, there are no set rules and regulations. And yet all the world looks for rules and regulations from outside as far as the art of living is concerned. Why is it that actually there are no regulations from outside? Because we live from within our own living self outwards. It is inside ourselves that salvation lies, not outside ourselves. Inside ourselves. Now, what we call inside ourselves is constantly interacting with what we call outside ourselves. So, if we are awake to the fact and we use our senses quite purely and simply, then we get into harmony between what we commonly call the self and the not self. And the separation between the not self and the self begins to dissolve. Then we live totally, fully, as the true human. Who is the true human? The word human is derived from the Sanskrit man, meaning to create. Its ultimate meaning is to create. And the prefix hu, and in some words the prefix is su, su or hu are interchangeable terms, means the blissful. You and I as human beings are blissful creators. That is what we really are. And as blissful creators, we within ourselves are not separate from that which appears separate from the body. In this single universal totality, every individual is wholly contained in complete interrelationship. It is that complete interrelationship to which we have to become alive and responsive. Then there is harmony in our own lives. Then there is the possibility of true fulfillment. Something which is not predetermined by our desires or our intellectual processes as they are. Then a new kind of mind comes into being, functioning through this very living organism, oneself. The kind of mind which we call the mind of God. This mind as a creative energy. In Genesis you have, and God said, let there be so and so, and there was so and so. Can you and I do that? Can we say, let there be so and so, and immediately so and so is there? But this is a very profound and deep truth. Now, this is the supreme and fundamental meaning of the word man. Man, the creative power of, the only word we have in our human languages is thought for man. But we don't know what real thought is as a creative power. We only know thought as a string of words in the language which makes limited sense in a limited context. That is all we know. What is it? It's time. Now, we have to realize this, understand it. And if we use this as a starting point for understanding, then we can find our own way to our true freedom and liberation. And in that is our fulfillment.